This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, I think we are seeing a hopeful trend across the country. Cases are clearly declining. The positivity rate's about 3.3% right now. Hospitalizations are falling as well, which is a good indication. And even in hard-hit areas like Michigan, which had late epidemics, late surges, you're seeing cases start to come down. I think whereas the past trends, when we saw cases start to decline, we were somewhat skeptical because we knew a lot of those declines were a result of behavioral changes, people pulling back more, taking more precautions. And then as soon as we sort of let our guard down, we saw cases surge again. Right now, the declines that we're seeing, we can take to the bank. I think we can feel more assured because they're being driven by vaccinations.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. Good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. That audio was from Face the Nation yesterday on CBS News. We are seeing some good numbers, even in some of the harder hit areas in terms of infections, in terms of hospitalizations, in terms of deaths. We're seeing them in surprising areas, too. Areas that had been more open have also shown some pretty marked improvements. So how do we understand, how do we grasp what all of this means? Joining us to talk to us about that, plus some interesting policy changes over the last day or so, Dr. Robert Tabali. He practices in adult and pediatric infectious disease in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. He's also a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Illinois, and he's a very good friend of the show. Dr. Tabali, welcome back.
Great to be on with you today.
So, a lot of things to unpack, and of course, we're going to get calls. If you've got questions, give us a call at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Lots of questions about vaccines, lots of questions about what's going on with the disparity in cases in different areas of the United States. Let's start, though, with the effort now to become a little bit more of a global exporter of some of these solutions. This was over the last, 3 days or so. It's been a reversal of policy here. India's going through a horrific spike in COVID-19. Initially, the White House stuck with the same paradigm that they had been, that both administrations had been with all along, which was that we're going to make sure that we get the U.S. vaccinated first before we start sending our vaccines elsewhere. Over the weekend, that changed. How bad is it in India? And is this something that we could impact right now?
Well, it's very bad in India, and India has been setting records the last 4 or 5 days for the total number of new cases identified. Now, one of the issues with India is that not only do they have a shortage of oxygen and other supplies, but they really don't have the same testing ability.
Right.
So there's probably far more cases there in India than meets the eye. Now, today or yesterday in India, 353,000 new cases. The day before, about 350,000 new cases. And the death rate is rising dramatically, and the deaths are probably significantly underreported as well. Now, one thing that a lot of people don't know about India is that they have a very broad pharmaceutical industry, and they've actually been, if I can call it, remanufacturing vaccine in India. One type of vaccine they've been remanufacturing in their own plants there is actually the AstraZeneca vaccine. And then they've been also remanufacturing the Chinese vaccine, the Sinovac vaccine, which has really been shown independently to be, not much better than injecting salt water. They've been giving people the AstraZeneca vaccine in India in addition to the Chinese vaccine. Now, what happened with the Biden White House is that they're now going to be shipping AstraZeneca stock that is here in the United States to India to help them. Now, it's kind of like if you own the football, you get to decide what time the game starts and what time it ends, right?
Right, right.
So these vaccines were developed first in England and then in the United States, And so the goal is to try to vaccinate as many people as you can as quickly as possible so that you can achieve some degree of herd immunity between the vaccinated immunity and the natural immunity that occurs. And so I think what we're seeing here in the United States as a result of both natural infection and vaccination is that we're seeing a natural decline in cases due to an immune population and a decreasing reservoir of circulating virus. And so that's not happening in India yet. And around the world, outside of Europe and the United States, the world is vaccine poor, extremely vaccine poor.
Right.
And, you know, there's the Russian vaccine, the Sputnik V, which is an interesting vaccine. There's a Chinese vaccine. And then there's the AstraZeneca vaccine, which are, these are the major players in, if I could call it, the undeveloped world. And what's happening now in the United States is the U.S. is getting fairly saturated with vaccines, so there's not much opportunity anymore to vaccinate people in the U.S. And so this vaccine production that's occurring in the United States is going to turn itself, you know, across the oceans to other, you know, markets and undeveloped countries. Now, the AstraZeneca vaccine costs about $1.50 acquisition costs, but the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, not only do they require massive infrastructure to store them, and they've got a relatively short shelf life, but they're quite expensive by comparison, about, you know, over $20 a dose.
Exactly.
So there's a vaccine in the United States which will likely be approved, well, actually it'll be before the FDA pretty soon. I thought it'd be there by now, but probably within the next 2 weeks, called the Novavax.
Yes.
It's like the television show Nova followed by Vax. And I've talked about that a lot on this program, but it's a protein-based vaccine. So there's the messenger RNA vaccines we all know about, and then there's the what we call vector vaccines, which are virus linked with genes that make stuff, and that's the J&J vaccine, the Janssen, Johnson & Johnson, and the AstraZeneca vaccine. And then there's the Novavax vaccine, which is more like, kind of, I can call it a traditional vaccine. It's not so cutting edge. And so this is highly protective, with the exception of the South African strain, but that's in all the other vaccines as well. But it has some attributes in that it's relatively low cost, and it has a very long shelf life, and it can be stored in regular refrigerator temperatures. So it's anticipated, you know, they've already got stockpiles of millions of doses of this now, and it's anticipated that that vaccine will probably become one of the dominant players worldwide because of those attributes of storage and long shelf life and low cost. And you know, we don't know the data, but it probably, you know, would be expected to have one of the lower side effect profiles of vaccinations that are available.
Just
so
because
really
of the nature of it, yes.
Exactly.
We're speaking with Dr. Robert Tibbale and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. I want to you know, emphasize that these are going to be. We've always anticipated exporting a lot of vaccines, right? I mean, this is part of the plan. The idea was to develop one, you know, at least get one and stockpile it. Now we're going to have 3, 4, maybe 5 different vaccines that we can produce here in the United States, and some of which are suitable for export, like Novavax or Johnson & Johnson, because those are easily stored and don't require a ton of infrastructure and support, AstraZeneca being another one. The question is this the moment, right? Because as you said, we're getting to a point now where we've got enough vaccine in the system where we can massage supplies around the United States to get where, you know, more demand is at as opposed to less demand. And we are seeing more supplies come online in Pfizer and Moderna. We should be able to keep up with that. There is a risk in letting a hotspot like India or Brazil, which has been relying on the China vaccine, Chile, which has also been relying on China, there's a risk in letting those hotspots run. And the risk is generating more variants that might, and I say the word might advisedly, create problems with the vaccination and the immune profiles that we've already been able to establish if they come across and get into the United States. I mean, that's a risk that we have to factor into this, right?
That's 100% correct. Yeah. So we you know, naturally want to try to dampen it down on the homeland first, and then turn our attention to the hotspots in the world. We don't want new variants which are going to have which are not going to be well treated or well prevented by vaccine to emerge. And that's really kind of the benefit of wearing masks for the past year. It's not really that they protect you when you're wearing them, or that they so much protect other people. And we're seeing a lot of research coming out that they're not really that helpful at all in protecting against coronavirus. But look what they did for influenza. I mean, they just stopped influenza dead in its tracks. And one of the concerns that people like me have is patients getting infected with both influenza and coronavirus. We do know that those patients did very, very poorly. And if you get co-infected with both of those viruses, you could have transfer of genes that could create a much more aggressive coronavirus or a much more aggressive influenza. And so, you know, I know I hate wearing a mask. Everybody hates wearing a mask. Everybody wants to be mask-free. But it's been a good thing for controlling influenza, and there's an untold benefit there. And infection control, it's kind of like good anti-terrorism programs. The better you are at it, the more it seems like it's not worthwhile. It was a waste of energy because
right.
Nothing happened. Yeah. So I think we're turning the corner here in the U.S. My wife is currently in Japan, and she was telling me that it's amazing in Japan. They don't do anything like we do in the United States. Just everybody wears masks, but it's not like people are sanitizing their hands. They're normally clean people, obviously, but there's no 6 foot of distance between people. They're just as packed and crowded as ever. And she went to get her medical checkups, and she was talking with the doctors there, and they haven't even had access to vaccines yet. So
wow.
It's what we have with the opportunities we have in here in the United States are not well repeated around the world. So we've had it good. Now, fully about 2/3 of the population here in the United States, 60%, has had at least one dose of a vaccine. And probably about 80% of the people in the United States have either been vaccinated or had natural coronavirus infection. And so we're just on the verge of herd immunity here.
It's a really an amazing success story. Let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Bob in Frankfort, Illinois. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I've got a question for Dr. Tabali, and I hope I can get this out so it makes sense. I was listening to a talk show on a popular Chicago talk station, and a guy called in that was a doctor from Texas, and he made the statement that with the mRNA vaccines, that we have an enzyme in our body that eliminates the mRNA within about 6 hours of getting the injection. Does that make sense? Can that be true?
Thank you, Bob. Dr. Tabali, what have you heard about that?
The messenger RNA by itself degrades fairly rapidly. So like if you spilled the vaccine on a countertop or something, within 15 to 20 minutes it would be degraded. DNA lasts a long time. That's a double-stranded genetic material, but RNA is single-stranded. It degrades very rapidly. And that's why they put it in this envelope of the polyethylene glycol, you know, to kind of protect it.
Right.
And allow it to slip into muscle cells when it's injected into the muscle. What that gentleman said is pretty accurate. But the messenger RNA that's injected into a vaccine recipient of either the Pfizer or Moderna, that messenger RNA does not. It's not long-lasting. It's not incorporated into human cells on a permanent basis. But it does create a little factory in the muscle cells where it gets put into, where those muscle cells make the spike protein, and that's where you get your immune response. It's not actually directly from the vaccine itself. It's from that spike protein product that the messenger RNA does in skeletal muscle cell. And then that's resolved pretty quickly. But in order, a lot of people think that it changes your DNA, but in order to do that, you'd have to have something called a retrovirus or a similar material. And the most common retrovirus is the HIV virus. There's only a few retroviruses known to us. HIV patients were included in the initial studies, and they found no evidence of, uptake of the messenger RNA of genetic material into human cells at that time. So I think we can be pretty highly confident that it does not change your DNA.
Yep.
It's close to 100% confidence on that.
And it's and if you take a look at the results of this too, I mean, I think what might be happening is people are hearing one small part of the mechanism of this and not looking at the overall results. If you take a look at Israel, which used Pfizer mRNA almost exclusively, they over the weekend they had 2 days in a row with no deaths, which was the first time in over a year that it happened. They had no recorded COVID-19 deaths. It's very effective. And we're seeing that from real-world data. We're seeing that even in the so-called breakthrough infections, Dr. Dabali, right? I mean, the breakthrough infections are less than 1%, so far, at least less than 1%.
And not only that, when the people that develop the breakthrough infections, they have significantly less severe infections, and they have almost non-detectable viral DNA in their nasopharynx, in their nose and passages where they would transmit it to other people. So the breakthrough infections are very, very mild. That's not to say that when you're talking millions and millions and millions of people, there's going to be a few people that have a breakthrough infection that's not mild, but it's a great benefit. The vaccines, this year has been very difficult for everybody, myself included, and I'm just so thankful that these vaccines are available. Now we have these therapeutics that are actually going unused now. The monoclonal and polyclonal antibodies, like the product that President Trump got before he went into the hospital.
Yes,
these are available for use in most emergency rooms, and there's no shortage of them. And they're actually hardly being used at all at this time. They're way underutilized. But in all honesty, in my clinical practice, in this area of the world where I am, we've seen a tremendous decline in COVID-related questions, situations, patient presentations. It's in the past 2 to 3 months, it's been rather dramatic. We used to go from having 60 to 80 COVID calls a day, now to having maybe one every other day. It's very heartwarming, and hopefully in Michigan they'll get past it pretty soon. If you don't have access to a vaccination and you're not going to take a vaccination, it's very important that you take vitamin D3, at least 2,000 to 4,000 units a day, and zinc, any size supplement a day, because these two things, if you have low levels, and almost everybody in the northern United States has low vitamin D levels, but if you have, especially if you're a person of color. If you have low vitamin D levels and low zinc levels, you have a much higher rate of severe disease if you get COVID. They actually help you survive COVID if you have normal levels before you get it. So word to the wise there. And
is that what's going on in Texas and Florida, do you think? Plus the warm weather and people congregating more outside than inside. I mean, it's sort of been a conundrum. You saw, Texas and Florida and their mandates and their lockdowns early on this year. And the people were expecting the cases to explode down there. Turned out it never happened that way. Whereas in Michigan, they were keeping things a little bit more locked down and you have this tremendous spike. Do you think that the vitamin D3 slash zinc levels have something to do with that? People in warmer, sunnier climates tend to have more naturally produced vitamin D in their bodies.
I think you're onto something there because, like in Minnesota and Michigan, they have some of the lowest vitamin D levels, the average vitamin D levels of any place, certainly in the United States. And in the southern climates where people are outdoors in the sun more often, they have much, much higher vitamin D levels. So we might not understand what the real reason is for years to come, but I'm sure people are looking into that right now. But that's probably one of the reasons.
Let's go back to the phones. Mark in Minnesota has been waiting patiently.
And I had watched a video of a doctor with very good credentials saying how the government gave them ivermectin, and it was working really good. He said it pretty much wiped out the coronavirus, and that was about a month ago. And now all of a sudden they're getting this awful spike. What happened? Did they run out of this ivermectin? And was it true? Does ivermectin really treat COVID?
Great question, Mark. I had a friend actually who had an experience with ivermectin and swore by it as well. He's in California. But I got the impression it was more of a treatment for an acute case than a preventative.
You know, ivermectin, very interesting medicine. It's an antiparasitic used for river blindness in middle of Africa and so on, and also hydroxychloroquine. Now, that's a term that a lot of people have forgotten about. But India was using hydroxychloroquine early on, but both ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine have multiple modes of action which seem to inhibit the absorption, or if I can call it the absorption or the uptake of the virus, and then inhibit the virus's ability to take over the cellular machinery inside a cell. And hydroxychloroquine has been rehabilitated in the scientific world recently, I believe. You know, it's not... It's not anathema to talk about it so much anymore, but it may be related to the use of calcium. You know how the cell uses calcium inside the cellular environment. It's quite complex. They're looking at it now, but the data, which if you want to look at the data, there's this website, wonderful website, C19study.com. That's C as in Corona, 19. Study.com, but it's got all the ivermectin studies listed there, all the hydroxychloroquine studies there, all the monoclonal and polyclonal antibodies, all the remdesivir studies. But they both appear to be effective. I've not prescribed ivermectin for anybody. I've treated a lot of people with hydroxychloroquine. It's a relatively short duration, about 10 days or less. And then there's this antidepressant. I'm blanking on the name. It was on 60 Minutes. And then the next week, that's all I got questions on was that antidepressant, and that has appears to have some significant effect on the virus's ability to be replicated in the cells. Not 100% cures, but they all appear to have some degree of activity.
Yeah, Dr. Robert Tabali, can we keep you past the break? We've got a number of phone calls that we want to get through. Can keep you for a few minutes longer.
Sure thing.
Great. We're talking with Dr. Robert Tabali. We're taking your calls. If you're on the line, stay on the line. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Your news, your issues, your opinions. Now, the Drew Mariani Show is here for you at 888-914-9149. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey from hotair.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Just a reminder, today at 5 Central Time, the Cale Clark Show will feature Dr. Peter Kreft. He'll be on to talk about issues dividing Western civilization and what can be done to remedy it. So be sure to stay tuned for that. Later in this half hour, we're going to bring on Selena Zito. We are still talking, though, with Dr. Robert Tabali about your questions on COVID-19 vaccines and the rest. Dr. Tabali has been kind enough to stick around for a few more minutes so that we can get some of these questions answered. Let's go to Vicki in Versailles, Kentucky. Vicki, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Dr. Tabali, I have a question. I have an autoimmune disease, and my doctor had advised me against taking anything that would suppress my immune system even further. And I was wondering, the Novavax, Is it going to be safe for people with suppressed systems to be able to take?
That's a good question, Vicki. And Dr. DiBala, I want to add in, my wife is also immune suppressed. She's had a kidney transplant. She had the mRNA. She had Moderna. And I'd be curious to know if you've gotten any data back on that issue with immune suppression as well.
Yeah, I personally don't have data in front of me on patients with what we call pharmacological immunosuppression, you know, where you're on a
right.
monoclonal antibody or a bunch of other things to push down your immune system so that you don't have the autoimmune disease. We do know that the messenger RNA vaccines, the Pfizer and the Moderna, can actually upregulate the autoimmune activity. So so a lot of people with autoimmune disease like lupus or other issues have been recommended maybe to defer the messenger RNA to either have a Johnson & Johnson vaccine, or my recommendation is for the Novavax. I think that that's going to be the vaccine that people with autoimmune disorders like lupus and so on would be the preferred agent in those situations. Now, I'm getting a little ahead of the data here because we don't have data on the Novavax.
Right.
But there's quite a bit of information on the messenger RNA vaccines that they do upregulate autoimmune activity. And me personally, I do what I can to avoid recommending the Johnson & Johnson vaccine just simply because it has a very close association with the aborted fetal cell lines and so on. So that's from my own personal recommendations, but it'll be interesting to see. We'll know better in the future, but we just don't know right now.
And the Novavax does not, because I know a lot of people are going to be wondering about that. The Novavax does not have an association with the aborted fetal lines, right?
It's not raised with it. It wasn't developed with it. But again, there was a little bit of testing, initially when they first developed the vaccine. Not too dissimilar from the Moderna and the Pfizer,
sure.
But it's not an ongoing effort. You know, it's not an ongoing thing. So,
right.
But it was not developed, and it's not manufactured with aborted fetal cell lines.
Well, let's try to get a couple more calls in here. Joan in Thousand Oaks, California. Welcome to the show. Great to be speaking with you today.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, doctor. You answered kind of one of my questions. I was waiting for the Novavax for myself and for my autistic epileptic son, who's on a variety of medications, because of the lack of fetal cell line, cooperation. I was sad to see that it was used in some of the testing, like the Pfizer and Moderna, but also I liked it because it was more of a traditional vaccine, and I felt more tried and true, than some of these long-term side effects that we really don't know may occur from the RNA vaccines. Is it worthwhile to wait for the Novavax, or is the Pfizer and Moderna, the way to go? Because my family's pressuring me thoroughly, and they've all been taking the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines.
Great question.
I personally think it's worthwhile, and that's the one I'm waiting for, and it'll probably be released for use under the emergency utilization authorization probably within the next 4 weeks. I mean, they were expecting to have that data before the FDA by the end of April, and it would normally take about 2 weeks for the review. So I based on the data in Great Britain and South Africa already, it has a very high degree of efficacy. It's very safe, and it has a low side effect profile. Now, we may see something different in the United States trials, but it appears to be as good in many ways as the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine with less risk, less downside risk. So if you have any question at all about, could the Moderna or Pfizer cause a problem, and in most situations they won't, but they could. I think waiting another month for the Novavax is a reasonable thing to do. I had life-threatening COVID back in March of last year. I quite honestly thought that I was not going to survive, and I believe I got it again a couple months ago. My antibodies were positive, and then they left me within about 4 months. But the second round that I had was far less severe. It only lasted for about 36 hours. But the Novavax is the vaccine that I'm waiting to get because I'm concerned that if I take the Moderna or Pfizer, I may have a severe augmented immunity type of issue. I'm going to get vaccinated, but it's going to be the Novavax.
All right, let's go to one more call before we let Dr. Tabali go. Sue in Philadelphia, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question was, my mom received both shots of the Moderna, and the second shot, I think they hit on her arm. I think they hit her vein, so it got black and blue for a couple of weeks. It went away. So I was just wondering, was that, you know, you spoke about putting it in the muscle, but was that valid then? If it went in the vein?
They might have lanced a vein while the needle was going through the skin. And there is kind of a rash that some people get after the administration, which kind of a circle red rash that comes out within 24 hours and stays for a few days. Some people have had like a kind of a black and bluish. But if it was the frank black and blue that, you know, you got as kids when you punched each other in the shoulder, then probably what they did was when they stuck the needle in. They have to use a deep needle to make sure they get it in the muscle and not delivered into fat. But they may have actually crossed a vein and caused some bleeding under the skin. I wouldn't worry about it, and I hope she's doing well after her vaccine.
Is there a way to test for that? I mean, do we have a reliable antibody / T cell response test yet? I know this is something they've been talking about for a year, Dr. Tabali. I'm going to make this the last question because you've been very generous with your time. But are they developing a test here that will reliably tell people what their level of resistance to COVID-19 might be?
Well, the T-cell test is kind of more of a research tool right now. It's not really commercially available widely. But the antibody test, there's actually a very, very good antibody test. It's not the first, not the second. It's more like a third-generation antibody test that's available now. And if somebody wanted to get it, the insurance companies are not paying for it. So you'd have to pay for it out of pocket. But the interesting thing, you know, if somebody got one Moderna or Pfizer vaccine, actually the data was on Pfizer, but if they got one Pfizer vaccine after having a natural course of COVID, their antibodies went up 140 times, and their T cell activity went off the charts. So, the vaccine schedule really probably will be one dose of vaccine if you had approved COVID infection in the past. But these vaccines are just very, very excellent about stimulating immunity. So.
Well, it's great news, and it's always great to talk to you, Dr. Tabali, and for you to spend time here. Dr. Robert Tabali practices in adult and pediatric infectious disease in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. He's also a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the University of Illinois, and thank you so much for being with us today, sir.
Great to be with you. I always like it when you're on. Thanks.
Well, thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Dr. Robert Tabali has been our guest. Joining us now is one of my good friends, a great reporter, one of the people who really has her finger on the pulse of Middle America, Selena Zito of SelenaZito.com. She also writes at the Washington Examiner, the New York Post, does excellent work. You've heard her here many, many times. It's been a long time, though, since I've had a chance to talk with Selena, so welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I miss talking to you.
I miss talking to you, too. You know, it's funny because Selena and I would send each other messages on Twitter all the time, and Selena has taken a well-considered respite from Twitter. So
I deactivated my account. It's gone. There's no going back.
Oh, you have burned the ships at the shore. You are completely out of the Twitter fold. And so we haven't had a chance to chat much, but I was so looking forward to this. I went over to SelenaZito.com to see what you'd been writing lately. And one of the things that I saw over at SelenaZito.com is you got this really great picture of yourself that's right up there on the site. And I was wondering where you got that picture, Selena.
That picture was from is that the one where I look like I'm wistfully staring off into space?
That's the one. That's the picture I'm talking about, Selena.
that's the one my daughter my daughter took of me at her wedding.
Oh, that's
she just,
great!
Saw me smiling and watching the whole family together, and I didn't even know she took the photo until she sent it to me.
Well, that's terrific. And like I said, it's great to talk with you. You're doing such great work. And one of the things that we're going to talk about here today is your latest piece at the Washington Examiner, Ancient and Lonely Urban Monuments Evoke Today's Political Division. And I think that this is really interesting to talk about anyway. But we spoke about this in the very first segment of today's show. You had this really interesting moment in a cultural institution. It's not a physical institution, but it was at the Oscars when Tyler Perry got up and said, you know, I refuse to hate. I want to meet people in the middle. I want to engage people. If you refuse to hate and want to engage people, meet me in the middle and I'll be there for you. And I thought that was a remarkable response to sort of an institutional, closure that has been going on in that particular sense. So looking at the physical urban monuments and the way that they invoke political division, I think that there's a thirst for getting past that, right? And that's one of the things that you talk about in your essay here is how the singular focus on just one little aspect or one, even if it's one major aspect, really eliminates the nuances of history, of our culture, and locks us out of making those connections.
Yeah, making those connections, having interesting conversations, having interesting dialogues. One of the things we absolutely have loved historically doing in our country is and it has been part of what has made us unique and exceptional because we came from so many different backgrounds and so many different nationalities. But when we came here, we were American, and everything that we bring with us makes us better rather than subtracts from it. But the way that our culture has gone lately is that everything that we bring with us is now baggage and bad, and it should not be brought up for discussion or for scrutiny. And so we lose that richness of you know, feeding off of each other and reaching each other and learning new things from us, from each other. So I didn't even know the Oscars were last night, but that was really wonderful I'm really disconnected from our culture. I'm really disconnected from that whole part of our culture, and I'm healthier that way.
Well, but, you're disconnected from an online culture, right? But you're not disconnected. You're not disconnected from American culture because you're actually out talking to people.
I just got back from Kentucky. I spent a week down there, interviewed Daniel Cameron, the new attorney general in Kentucky, first Republican to win a statewide office to win that seat since 1944, and the first Black to win any statewide office independently in the state ever. Also a conversation with Mitch McConnell, but also did some fun reporting on bourbon and sort of how that reflects who we are in this country and American exceptionalism. So like I'm always out there, but I'm not plugged into my phone anymore. And honestly, I think it makes me a better reporter and better at my job. And also, I don't get to see people be mean to each other all the time, and I don't like that.
Yeah, I think that there's a definite degradation culture in social media, and I think it feeds into this perception, right? And, I mean, because we're talking about this in terms of how people are using these older historical monuments to divide, and that's very apparent on social media. Whereas it's not it really isn't in real life, I guess you can say, IRL. It's not really that way in real life, or at least it hasn't been.
Yeah, absolutely. So the story I wrote about that you're discussing, and you guys can check out everything I do at SelenaZio.com, but the story you're focusing on is Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, last week said that racism is built into the building of our roads and our infrastructure. And when you throw race into everything that happens, the discussion dies there, and you're unable to win over people who might be interested in what you're going to talk about if that is the opening dialogue. And I took a look at infrastructure in my own backyard.
Selena, I'm going to have you hold on right there because I want to get back to the infrastructure in your own backyard. We're talking with Selena Zito of WashingtonExaminer.com. And we'll be taking your calls when we come back. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. Stay tuned.
On Relevant Radio, call in now at 888-914-9149 to tell Drew what you think.
It's 49 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. We're speaking with my friend Selena Zito, reporter and columnist for the Washington Examiner and the New York Post. She's the author of The Great Revolt, and she previously wrote for The Atlantic and spent 11 years at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, both as a reporter and columnist covering national politics. And she is one of the best reporters, if not the best, keeping her finger on the pulse of Middle America, and that's what she's talking about right now, culturally speaking. And you were just about to talk to us, Selena, about Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg's declaration that racism is built into the built into our highways. And whenever you start off a conversation, you were making this point too. Whenever you start off a conversation talking about immutable characteristics as being the primary issue, there is no place for this conversation to go after that. I mean, there's literally nowhere to
right.
go.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The minute the word race or racism is thrown into a conversation, the conversation ends. Because the person that is absorbing this information knows that they have two choices. To say, well, I'm not racist. Well, that is as soon as you say that, then you're automatically deemed as racist. Try to push back on that allegation, and once again, you're cornered, and there's no good answer, and so then the conversation dies, and the person who throws the word, well, that's just racist, out. Ultimately wins the conversation by default because they brought the sharpest weapon to the word fight. And so the truth is infrastructure in this country has more been an inside-outside problem. In other words, if you look around in old Rust Belt cities, Great Lakes, Midwest cities, Appalachian cities or towns, even rural areas, the homes and the buildings that were destroyed first or exclusively were the ones with the people with no political capital, the ones that didn't have any political capital with whoever was in power. Mostly it was Democrats because most of our big infrastructure has come since the 1930s. And during the 1930s, that's when all of our cities and towns became Democrat ruled. So the true story about our nation's infrastructure is that the working class and the poor and the middle class have always been the ones whose homes or communities were expendable. we're just going to plow this over because we want to connect the suburbs with the city, or we're just going to plow this over because we want to put an interstate in here, and with no regard to how that to the people that they're dislocating. And so, and that was based on like tons of research and facts, but also having lived through it myself. And so I think Buttigieg did the administration a disservice by saying, oh, it's racist. No, it's actually more elitist.
Right. Well, and I would argue that when we're talking about communities that don't have political power, sometimes race plays into that. I mean, but it's not the only factor. And you see that
right.
in some
sometimes,
of these.
But it's, yes, sometimes it does. Most of the time, it's just because you're poor or it's just because you're a working class. And we don't need you. We don't need you. You don't have any political capital. So, you know, I don't need your vote. Oh, and or you're going to vote for me anyways because you don't have any other choice.
So. In Pittsburgh, you talk about how this played out in Pittsburgh, and I mean, I think that this is really eye-opening, and because I know that you feel this history very deeply. You're very much a Pittsburgh person. You had a number of things that's happening in Pittsburgh in this period of time, right? The steel industry is collapsing. You have lots of people who are unemployed. You have urban planners coming in and doing all sorts of different things here in attempts to deal with that situation and to do, you know, because of their own plans. So what was the experience in Pittsburgh like during this period of time?
Well, the areas that fell were working class black neighborhood in the Hill District. But also a working-class immigrant neighborhood, and they were just considered expendable.
And because they just didn't have representation for with the people who are making these decisions. And again, when you're talking about this sort of urban planning and urban revitalization, this is really top-down government. It's a I'm trying to get the right words for this, but basically this is really a group of elites that are going to decide that are trying to decide how people are going to live their lives. And they're going to physically impose that vision on the areas that they see need it the most. And that's not going to be the rich people.
Right. I mean, in the Hill District, this is a very famous black neighborhood in Pittsburgh. They declared it a slum and a blight. It wasn't. Was it crowded? Absolutely. Were there some poor people there? Absolutely. But it was also the most culturally rich neighborhood in our city. One of the things that make Pittsburgh so unique is the nearly 90 different neighborhoods located within the city limits. The same with E Street. It was, I mean, so the Hill District was demolished to put an opera house. It ended up becoming a hockey arena eventually. It was called the Civic Arena. But to put an opera house, the original place that it was supposed to be located was in an area called Highland Park. Well, that's where all the rich people were. They had political capital. They threw a fit. And it ended up being put in the poor black neighborhood. The same way with the highway that connects the northern suburbs with the city. This was a mostly German immigrant neighborhood that had been there since the turn of the 19th century. And most of the people that lived in this neighborhood had paid their homes off. And they were given bargain, they were given very amounts offered for their homes. It actually became law because of what the government did to them. This is the Federal Highway Commission. They offered them pennies on the dollar for their homes, and they had to, you know, mortgage themselves to the hilt to buy other homes when they were already surpassed that part in their lifetime. I mean, I can remember people committing suicide over
over just the economic and financial despair and the breakup of this community.
Yeah, that's, you know, at the same time this is going on too, you have various different Great Society policies that are being implemented in other ways.
Yep.
And you start seeing people moving out of the cities. You know, I'm sure that was true in Pittsburgh. One of the most dramatic examples, I think, is Cincinnati, actually, where you had this enormous flight out of the city. And it's the city is, what, 40% lower population than it was 40 years ago or 50 years ago. It's never recovered. People won't move back. And that isn't, that's not really about race. That's about policy, and it's about interventionism, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned the Great Society. You know, I always thought it was so insulting to take people out of their homes and build these Soviet bloc-style projects and place people in these projects. And people were living on top of each other. And they were selling it as this, like, utopian society. But when, in fact, it actually forced people to be dependent on the government. And they gave up homes they owned to then pay the government low prices for these homes.
Selena, we're going to have to leave it there for now. SelenaZito.com, that's where you can find this. SelenaZito.com. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. Have a great evening, folks.